newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember...
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on the media issues of the week. And we invite you to join us as we talk about these issues and invite your thoughts as well. I'm Rex Smith, editor-at-large of the Times Union, with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. You're doing well, Alan, I hope?
Well, you know, a little cabin fever.
He's doing
otherwise, we're fine, yeah.
Good. Cabin fever, I think we're all a part of that. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist and U Albany professor. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. A little bored.
And in Rosemary's case, when she gets bored, we're all in trouble.
Yeah, that's right. She's going to cause you trouble, Alan. Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association and longtime editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. Judy, what's going on?
You know, I'm feeling a little bored and a little distant as well. Glad to get together with you all.
Good, good. Well, I'm not feeling bored yet. I'm feeling as though I'm just waiting for that to happen, but I keep getting things interfering with my leisure time. The career of a former newspaper editor, now part-time in that role, is still daunting, I've discovered. But that's okay. We're all doing the little things that we can. You know what a lot of people are doing, obviously, is watching television. It turns out that the cable channels are having huge audiences. Fox News has never been more popular. Their last month is the most popular month ever. And CNN and MSNBC are similarly huge. In fact, combined, they're just about the same. They're about the same as Fox News being by far the largest of the Fox channels. So I guess people are getting their doses from cable TV, right?
Also Netflix and Zoom.
Yes.
Everybody's Zooming now. No question about it.
There was an interesting article in the New York Times about how Zoom gives you a headache, basically. It leaves you disoriented. It is not the same as meeting people face-to-face. It's like watching Hollywood Squares, and you're one of the squares. So, yes, I'm one of those people who has turned to TV, although I have to say not Fox.
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting because Fox is coming in for a certain amount of criticism now because the president of the United States is not happy with Fox, and he's making those feelings known. So you had all these people who think they're on the one side. Now, I've tried watching a little bit, and I find it to be pretty reprehensible still, with the exception, you know, of Chris Wallace. Otherwise, it is interesting that an almost rabid president will turn on his own closest ally.
So the ratings at Fox are at an all-time high, but they're also at all-time highs at CNN and MSNBC. But if you watch them all day, and a lot of people have all day to watch them, they're very repetitive. It's one of the reasons I've come to realize that I like to listen to the Andrew Cuomo briefings every day, because you get a little bit of news. And the other thing I think is happening is people are hoping if they turn on the TV, somebody's going to come out and say it's over. You know, it's time to move on. The president may dislike or be unhappy with Fox, but the most recent news is he's having a town hall at the Lincoln Memorial with Fox. So that's a very good backdrop, a very good one-on-one. We'll have to see who, I guess, Fox will broadcast, but the other broadcast agencies won't. But, you know, I keep hoping that the broadcast news is going to say, okay, it's time we all go back to normal.
What does it say about us that we are in a situation where, as you say, Judy, we've got this huge audience for a blatantly biased conservative network? And if you believe that MSNBC and CNN are on the left, they have an audience of the same size. We really are divided, aren't we?
And in the past, these kind of national crises have brought people together. But this is so reflective of the partisan time we are in.
Alan, what do you think about that?
Well, actually, I was very taken with what Judy said. We expect that somebody will say, it's all over, we have found the cure. Now, there is this remdesivir, which is a new drug, which was created to fight Ebola. It didn't work. And now they've tried it here. And Dr. Fauci comes on and he says it shows real promise. Now, we don't believe, I don't, much that the president says, but when Fauci says it, it's extraordinary, I think. Then at the same time, we're hearing that over in England, at Oxford, they're coming up with a potential viral killer. So I don't know whether or not that is something that we can expect to see on the news, but we all hope so, and we watch it. When the president comes on, I turn to Gunsmoke myself, but each of us have a different way of doing that.
Rosemary?
Well, I think the problem is the opposite, that the press, like the president, is apt to call a cure and an end to this before it actually happens. If you listen to Fauci, he was extremely cautious, which then got lost when Trump started talking and when the market reacted. This new drug that shows what he called promise is not a cure. It's not a vaccination. It's been suspended. Trials have been suspended in Europe because of awful patient reactions. And the truth of the matter is that at its best, it reduces the days of suffering from 15 days to 11. It is not the end of coronavirus. And the press has to be really careful of that. We have a tendency in reporting on science and medicine to get kind of all winded in, like, oh, wow, this is so cool. It isn't yet. It may be. I hope it is, but it isn't.
I think you have a good point there, that it's very difficult for you to convey the subtlety in a story when a headline has to be written in four or five words in print, reflects the very short amount of time available to broadcast. We're not as good as we ought to be at reporting about science and the subtlety of this particular drug being only something that perhaps maybe can shorten the recovery time. That may be promising that it at least has some reaction, but it's really difficult for us to not overdo it. And then the public runs with it and we report on how the market reacts to the reporting that lacks subtlety to begin with.
Now, I want to say one thing, and that is that CNN has done a remarkable job. They have had that very chart that Rosemary was talking about, you know, the difference between days and how long, again and again and again. So I think they were responsible about it.
Report what that chart is, Alan. What does it say?
It's the one that Rosemary just referred to, which is the difference between the sugar pill that they gave to people and the remdesivir and how it did. And so it's, you know, a difference of what, Rosemary, did you say 11 days, something like that?
Yes. If you didn't take the drug, you suffered 15 days. If you did, right, it went down to 11, which is not insignificant if you're suffering. I grant you. And yes, it's definitely good that the drug shows promise rather than was a complete failure. But it is so far from a happy cure or near cure that makes the markets jump that I'm just shaking my head at it.
Yeah. You know, it is difficult when you're making judgments about what story to play, if you're a producer or an editor, to make the choice between reporting what is new and different and reporting what is the reality. There was a very thoughtful piece, I thought, in Columbia Journalism Review about crowd photos, which is a similar issue to this in deciding what the appropriate play for something that is different is. This had to do with the question of running photographs of people blocking the beaches in California, Florida, and Texas, all these people showing up. And the question is, photos of crowded public spaces may show the reality, but the reality also is that if you turn the camera the other direction, you've got miles and miles of empty beaches. People actually do respect social distancing guidelines. How do you make those choices? Judy, you want to start with that?
The danger with those photos is they offer no context because you might see a group of people being close together, but they might be in the same family. They're perfectly fine to walk together holding hands down the beach. And you don't know that when you see the photo. Photos are remarkably dangerous because they're so easily shared. You know, they're essentially clickbait, and they can be dangerous because people make judgments. They make emotional judgments. All those crazy people, you know, on the beach, they shouldn't be doing that. It's just like what a lot of people are experiencing is when they go to the grocery store, when they go out for a walk, they make judgments about people hanging out together. And I think it's, you know, probably it's a natural thing to try to do, but you really have to think to yourself, you know, maybe they're family members. Maybe, you know, they are doing their own kind of social distancing. We just don't know. And this is a case where words sometimes do a better job than a photo.
Rosemary?
I think that Judy's right, but those are decisions and judgments made by individual readers and listeners. I think the media has to cover the story, just like taking pictures of empty shelves may not help the hoarding situation. Don't ignore it so as to possibly prevent a worsening of the situation. When you have crowds gathering, for example, at a rabbi's funeral in New York City or at a beach or at an anti-lockdown protest in North Carolina, you take the pictures and you tell the words. We just can't make people read the words. They're going to form their judgments anyway.
That's correct. You can't make people read the words. But now, about the protests, you know, here we may have a few hundred people protesting the closures of government and of our lives, the shutdowns. And yet polling shows that by a huge, huge majority, people want the protection that the shutdown presents. So how do you avoid the misunderstanding that your coverage might present of people reflecting something that, in fact, is not the fulsome reality? Alan?
Well, I was just very taken by the last remark about the mayor shutting down the Hasidic funeral. I've been to some of these, and they are unbelievable. One person standing next to another. He comes in and says, look, this is terribly dangerous. I'm going to call in the police. I'm going to make sure that it doesn't happen. Within hours, he was on television apologizing and saying that any suggestion that people are making that he said that Jews should not have funerals, in other words, that this was an anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic move on his part. So the media has to be very careful about that.
They can't stop covering it. That funeral was a story. Pictures of those people on the beach in that protest are pictures, are newsworthy in my view, and you fix misunderstanding not by shutting up and stopping the coverage, but by doing more talking, more shows like this, more stories and explainers in the opinion section that explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. And you apologize if there's a mistake, just like the mayor did. I don't think the answer ever in media is like, okay, we won't cover it. Cover-ups don't work.
You know, what you're saying is that great journalism always includes context. And so it is important to note that some people don't have, of course, the luxury of a garden of their own to hang out in or a beautiful suburban neighborhood to walk around in. And so if people in an urban setting are walking down the street, you know, I think that it is important to try as well as we can to present the full reality of what's going on, rather than to say we use our journalism to be scornful of people who seem to be, by our standards, behaving in a way that we think is inappropriate.
That was very carefully said, and yes, I agree with it, but also there's some room for reporting about the consequences of that behavior. For example, there's a story about the leader of the anti-lockdown protests in North Carolina just tested positive for coronavirus. So questions about, oh, how many people did she infect that day she was out marching against lockdowns? I think those are appropriate, too. And if that's scornful, so be it. We're in an epidemic.
Yeah. You're right. Absolutely so. Well put. And, you know, we end up doing a lot of journalism these days that has to do with the people who are our victims. And in a certain context, journalists don't like doing what we derisively refer to as puff pieces. We don't like doing stories that just glorify folks. In this time frame, when there is so much bad news around, writing stories about folks who are doing remarkable work on the front lines or writing stories about the dead is an important part of our job. And the aversion to puff pieces may be, at this point, misplaced. You think?
I think there's a big problem here. The news media has been reporting on a regular basis the numbers of people who are dead in the world, the number of people who are dead here, the number of people who have it. A number is not a person. And I think our big problem here is that as a result, we become immune because we hear these huge numbers, but it doesn't mean anything. It's a statistic, as opposed to Joe died and he left a family and they're all in mourning. And then all of a sudden you get an idea of what's going on here. So I think that's a call that the editors have to make also.
Judy, you were going to say?
You know, and putting a human face on this virus helps people better understand it, or it gives it meaning to them in a new way that they aren't just numbers. What I find, because I'm watching a lot of news, is that there is a heavy focus on the politics of it and less so on the human qualities and on the science reporting and all the other news that's getting lost in the meantime. But the reality is a lot of what's happening is heroic and does need to have a light shone on it. And, you know, traditionally, the features reporters in a newsroom sometimes aren't given the respect they deserve. And this is one of those instances where a feature reporter can really do a stellar job of conveying the reality of what we're living through.
Rosemary, you focused your career on investigative reporting, and you've been a managing editor. And I'm just wondering, if you were running a newsroom now, what do you think we have not done enough of? What would you be saying, let's focus more attention on this?
That's interesting. I would not discontinue the feature stories we've just been talking about. I do not equate them with the kind of puff pieces like animal stories that don't involve mangled children, cute dog stories. That's stuff we don't like to do. But biographies of people, those totally need to be done. And I applaud that. I think that I always hated that obits went away as our financial problems got so bad and people now have to pay to tell the stories of their loved ones. So I'm glad that that's back. But as for the virus itself, I am utterly confused on testing. How much has been done versus how much has been done elsewhere versus are the tests any good? I am utterly confused, and I read this stuff every day, hours every day. So if I'm confused, what about the normal people? And I want to know much more about what the scientists are doing to make the tests work. Like, do you really have to have a swab go right up your nose to your brain? Is that necessary? What are they testing? What's the difference between serology and virology? You know, we have to educate our public about medicine right now. I think there's lots to be done, and the media generally is doing it, on how we got in this situation. I totally disagree with the idea that now is not the time to look at how the administration messed up. Now is exactly the time we should be looking at that. And also, what has happened with the dismantled federal apparatus to deal with epidemic? We heard a lot about how Trump dismantled it. Is it put back together now?
Good. If there are some assigning editors out there and producers, take notes. I think that's a really good thing. Of course, the problem is there's so far fewer journalists doing that work these days. We regularly on this program talk about the financial peril confronting much of journalism. A lot of local journalism is in trouble. There are thousands fewer journalists reporting right now than there were a year ago. And just before this crisis hit, some of the major newspaper chains across the country did layoffs and furloughs and so on. Now, a new development on this, because we ought to pay attention when there may be some development that is relevant. Nearly three quarters of the U.S. Senate, more than half of the members of the U.S. House of Representatives, have signed a letter to the Trump administration encouraging agencies to increase advertising in local broadcast stations and newspapers in order to help ensure that they're able to continue operations through the pandemic. You know, Washington does a lot of advertising, like for the census and all that kind of thing. And so these, both Republican and Democratic legislators, often the Republicans are especially supportive of the president when he attacks fake news. Now they're standing up for local journalism. This seems like a good development, right? Judy, you want to talk about that?
One of the things that made me take notice this week when I was listening to Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, he talked about the need for advertising to getting the information out to the people about where they can get tested, basic information. And I think the local newspaper's ideal for this, and I support it. There is a regular budget for advertising at the federal level, at the state level. They tend to have shifted towards social media, and they don't use newspapers as much as they should have. This comes on the heels of, you know, the Small Business Administration loan program. A lot of newspapers, the smaller newspapers, were eligible for that money, but they, like so many other small businesses, were crowded out by the big guys. And so I think getting real advertising, real content, advertising can be good instructive content about where to get tested. I think run it in a local newspaper, run it on your local television station, and I think that makes perfect sense.
Alan?
Well, I think that the obituaries are a very good place to tell stories. I mean, when I read the New York Times every day, I read those obits, and some of the best reporters on the Times are now writing the obits. Sam Roberts, I believe, is one of them. And they are absolutely putting the face together with the pandemic. I don't know about you guys, but I think a good obit writer is an extraordinarily important part of a paper.
So I think that money from any source at a time when we're shedding reporters is a good idea. However, coming from Congress gives me a little bit of a headache because they can take it. First, I don't believe they're going to give it at all. I don't care how many senators sign it. Trump doesn't want it and it won't happen. But even if they did give it to us, are they going to take it away because the New York Times runs a story they don't like about them? It's not a long-term structural cure. If we have, for example, taxation that went into communication the way the BBC is set up, that might be a different thing. But largesse from government will give you legal ads for now while we like you. Slippery slope.
And remember, yeah. Rosemary, what they give, they can take away. And that is always the case. Can you imagine Donald Trump, who has named fake news all through this, who has led other despots around the world to say the same thing to their media? Can you imagine this guy saying, yeah, let's save them by giving them money? It doesn't seem that it's going to happen.
And yet, so far, the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has survived efforts by the White House, by this White House, to eliminate it. So far, there has been at least not a successful winding down. How does that happen? How is it that it's not a huge amount of money, granted, but how does that keep going?
Well, let me speak to that.
Alan?
Every congressman, we have a program on our station called the Congressional Corner, in which we regularly interview every congressman that'll come. Lee Stefanik doesn't show up, but otherwise they do, including the remarkable Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut. And also the boards of these public radio stations around the country. Ronald Reagan was the first one who tried to kill it. The boards from those stations almost inevitably feature some wealthy people. That doesn't exist in a lot of places like ours, but it does. And so then they call the president and say, oh, Ronnie, well, this is important. And, you know, it didn't work. So what they got done was they say all the money goes to Corporation for Public Broadcasting and none of the money goes to NPR, who they really hate. But it's ridiculous because we all have to give money to NPR to keep it going. That's part of the assessment process that we all face. So I think that's the answer to your question, Rex. I hope so.
Yes, every member of Congress has a stake in the local public broadcasting surviving. Yep. I guess that's it. You know, it isn't as useful for the news organizations that have been my career for newspapers, which are just being eaten away by the change in the business climate, by the loss of local advertising and the decline of brick and mortar stores. And so as that's going away, there isn't really a substitute for it. And that's why so many newspapers are in trouble. And the vast majority of the newspapers in the country are local, small, weekly newspapers. That's where most newspapers are. And there is no solution to that. We could have a solution that would include allowing newspapers to band together to negotiate with Google and Facebook, which take 60% of the advertising dollars on the digital side of things. But that would require a change in federal law. And the Trump administration is not likely to go for that, right?
Right.
We should note that Facebook announced this week or relatively recently that its profits have doubled. They're one of the few industries that aren't suffering at this point. Let's keep that in mind as we go forward and try to remember how important local reporters out covering local beats is for the functioning of our society and our democracy. That gets forgotten so much.
Rosemary, you want to have a last word on that?
No, because I agree with what was already said, especially by Judy. We are so bad at messaging, aren't we, that I say it's really important to read the Times Union and who believes me and why? What do I point to? Or how do I make it sexy in a way that pointing to an article that I saw on Facebook is not? I mean, you don't have quizzes on name a movie that begins with H. I put that on Facebook yesterday and got like 150 responses. The newspapers don't have that. So what's the message for us? If we could get that, we'd be okay.
All right. That is the hope. The end of the show, sadly enough. Rosemary Armijo gets the last word. Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, and I'm Rex Smith with gratitude to you for listening and to our producer, David Gustina, for making us sound a lot better than we actually are. Thanks, David. Thanks to you for listening, folks. Join us again next week on The Media Project.
City desk, hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-ling, ding-ling, ling-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor-at-large of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. And Rosemary Armeo is an investigative journalist and former chair of the Department of Journalism at the University at Albany. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.